The battles for Mosul and Raqqa, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. U.S.-backed forces are trying to reclaim cities in Iraq and Syria from ISIS. But this American general says the fight is far from over.
Mosul and Raqqa are intermediate objectives on a path to a final victory, but no one's changing their mind or changing what they're doing just because Raqqa and Mosul have been liberated.
We'll take you to the front lines, plus the story of Paul and Massa. He's American, she's Iranian. They want to get married, but they've been caught up in Trump's on-again, off-again travel bans.
Every time that there's a ban, I feel like I'm having a heart attack because I don't know if I can start my life with the person that I love.
We'll have the latest chapter in their story today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. 3 years ago this week, a shadowy figure named Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi stood in a mosque in Mosul, Iraq, and declared the Islamic State, ISIS, as we've come to know it. It was a caliphate, al-Baghdadi said, stretching across big parts of northern Iraq and Syria. Today, that mosque is in ruins. It was destroyed by ISIS fighters in Mosul as Iraqi forces closed in on them. There have been similar fighting going on for control of the Syrian city of Raqqa. Our BBC colleagues are on the front lines in both places. Let's go first to Orla Garin in Mosul.
In the old city area, the heart of the battlefield, we met families fleeing on foot through the narrow alleyways. Sepan Jassim sounded exhausted and looked frightened as he rushed away with his young sons. Our life was disastrous, he said. Five mortars landed on our house, and we were scared and hungry.
Do you think Daesh can be beaten?
We hope the righteous will win, he said. Well, I'm just walking into the driveway of a very large two-story house. There's a lot of rubble here in front of me. It looks like many other destroyed properties in western Mosul, but this one is different. Hanging from the window bars, just in front of me, there are handcuffs. This house was taken over by IS. They ran it as a prison. I'm here with a local man, Mohammed Abdul Karim, who's 30. He was held prisoner here for 5 days. Mohammed, tell me what you saw in that time.
They brought a prisoner here and tied him to a tree. They put water all over his body. Then they brought two electric cables and shocked him until he fainted. They woke him and did it again. Later, they rolled him up in a blanket.
Mohammed says the man was one of two he saw tortured to death. He told us if any of his neighbors who supported the extremists come back home, he will do the same to them. Though IS may soon be history here, this ancient city has new scars and new divisions.
The BBC's Orla Garin in Mosul, Iraq. Across the border near Raqqa in Syria, Gabriel Gatehouse has been meeting U.S. forces helping in the fight against ISIS, or Daesh, as some call it.
The caliphate may be weakened, but its mentality persists. On a dirt runway carved discreetly into a hillside, a U.S. military transport plane touches down. This is the main logistics hub for the American effort here in northern Syria. From this base, they support their own forces and arm the SDF, the coalition of Arabs and Kurds who are leading the assault on Raqqa.
Well, they're putting up barracks here, really. We've got about a dozen buildings going up here, soldiers digging trenches for electricity, a digger there. They say that they're made of bricks, made mostly of mud from the Euphrates River, so local materials that they say they can take down pretty quickly, but I have to say it does have the slight air of permanence about it. Well, all of this infrastructure has gone up in a really short space of time, and it's coincided with rapid advances by the anti-IS coalition. But the question is, what happens when the caliphate falls? Because as we know from Afghanistan and from Iraq, it's always easier to get in than it is to get out.
ISIS is certainly not defeated. When Mosul is liberated or Raqqa is liberated, there's a lot of hard work left to do.
That's General Stephen Townsend, the American commander in overall charge of the anti-IS coalition in Iraq and Syria.
I think it means we're not done anytime soon. We're certainly not done after the fall of Raqqa and Mosul. And actually, the World Coalition recognizes this, and I think it's a strong coalition, and there's nobody stepping back. And Mosul and Raqqa are intermediate objectives on a path to a final victory, but no one's changing their mind or changing what they're doing just because Raqqa and Mosul have been liberated.
U.S. Army General Stephen Townsend ending that report from the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse in Raqqa, Syria. Raqqa and Mosul are just the latest territories that ISIS is losing control of. A new report by the analytics group IHS Market says the militant organization has lost more than 60% of its territory. Ludovico Carlino is one of the researchers. I asked him how the losses are affecting ISIS.
Of course, that is impacting the Islamic State, especially when we consider that the Islamic State is running an economy based on taxation and confiscation of properties and also assets belonging to the population. So all the system that the Islamic State has been developing in the last 3 years now is gradually collapsing. So in 2015, monthly revenue was around $81
million. $81
million. Amount of money. Exactly. Now, the latest one, the new estimate is just $60 million. So we are speaking about a reduction of and a decline in revenue of about 80%.
So from $81 million down to $16
million. Exactly.
So that's a big drop. Is ISIS in a position to find other ways to bring revenue back up?
So I don't think so. For instance, we track every month all the new forms of taxation that Islamic State tried to introduce in the caliphate, also fines. And in the last, let's say, 7-8 months, we haven't seen anything, so any change in this system, which suggests that the capability of the Islamic State to exploit taxation on the local population has reached probably a limit. And they've been trying to be more creative in the way of generating money. So the Islamic State has been trying to enforce the use of this local currency, which I think is a way to increase the reserve of US dollars and Syrian pounds that the Islamic State will probably use in the coming months to, in some way, finance the insurgency that the group is preparing to launch once the territorial control will be completely over.
That was going to be my next question. I mean, what happens to the Islamic State if it continues to lose territory and revenue? Does it just kind of dry up?
Well, probably the caliphate as a proto-state that we see today will cease to exist. The group will continue to control some pocket of territory in Syria and Iraq and some small city. But that doesn't mean that the Islamic State will be over as a terrorist organization or as a group. And if you also look at the propaganda and the narrative that the Islamic State has been trying to push in the last, let's say, 7-8 months, they've been telling to the supporters that actually it's not the territorial control, which is important, but keeping alive the idea of the caliphate and keeping alive the idea of fighting to reach, you know, that aim. So the end of the territorial control is not whatsoever the end of the Islamic State for now.
Is there evidence to suggest that as the Islamic State recedes in size and revenue, that it is focusing its energy and attacks overseas?
I think that the idea of targeting other countries and having an external operational branch was something that the Islamic State has been planning for a long time. It's not something new. But then, yes, if we also see how the situation is developing in Syria and Iraq, when you have major defeat of the Islamic State in big cities like Mosul or Fallujah, you can expect also an increase on external operations. And this was the case, for instance, with the Philippines, while all the attention were on Mosul and territorial control that the Islamic State was actually losing in the city. Then we saw all the events in the Philippines, but also the attacks in the UK. So there is not a strict correlation between decline in territorial control and increase in external operation, but these are two dynamics that go hand by hand, actually.
Ludovico Carlino is a senior Middle East analyst at IHS Market. Thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
France is saying goodbye to one of its most admired public figures. Simone Veil was a Nazi death camp survivor who went on to become a leading feminist politician in France. She was also the first president of the European Parliament. And she's perhaps most widely remembered for writing her country's law legalizing abortion back in 1975, when the practice was still highly controversial there. Veil died today in Paris at the age of 89. Sophie Petter is the Paris bureau chief for The Economist. Sophie, tell us a little bit about Simone Veil.
She's just an extraordinary woman, one of those rare figures in history who really marked the century in France for various reasons. One of them was the fact that she was an Auschwitz survivor herself. Another was the fact that she was a campaigner for women's rights. I mean, she stood up in front of the French National Assembly at a time when there were very few women MPs and argued for abortion in a very sort of moving speech, but one that was quite brave of her to make. And she is therefore, she's remembered very much as a figure for feminism in France.
What was Veil's impact on France?
You know, she's remembered very much for her work in the legalization of abortion, but also previously in the early 1970s, she'd been health minister, and she had brought about a law to legalize contraception, in fact, to make it reimbursable under the French social security rules, so that it was really a sort of liberalization of rights for women. And, you know, if you remember back to 1968 in France, there was a youth student uprising against a very rigid French society, which was seen as conservative and authoritarian. And Simone Veil kind of realized that. She understood that society had to change, that there had to be more of a kind of liberation of women, but also a sense that, you know, the country needed to move with the times. And I think that it was that that really marked her out.
And of course, she had this moral gravity. You know, she had been sent to the camps. Her father and brother were last seen on a train to Lithuania. Her mother died in the camps. I think that also seems to have given her a moral gravitas.
I think it gave her a huge amount of moral influence over the nation and was one reason why that she was able to introduce a piece of legislation that was socially very controversial. You know, and she spoke about the time in the camps. It was very difficult for her to do it, but she was prepared to come out and talk about that experience. And I think that's very important for France, you know, which has had its own reckoning with collaboration with the Nazi regime in its own past. So I think it was important that the French came to hear her making those sorts of statements and reminding them of their part in what her family had to endure.
Earlier today, you tweeted out a picture in response to Simone Veil's death. It's a picture of the French Parliament in 1974 and the French Parliament today. Tell us about the tweet and why you wrote it.
Well, I've just been so struck this year by legislative elections in France. There's been a complete change in the face of the French Parliament. And there was a photograph which showed all the French female deputies who had lined up. There's almost no space on the steps to take this photograph. There are so many of them. And in fact, there are 224 French female deputies in this current parliament. And looking back at the time when Simone Veil was arguing for legalizing abortion, there were only 9 female deputies. So I think in a way, it was just that moment of realizing how far France has come, how far women in France have come, how far women in politics in France have come, and how this country has really been transformed over the last 30, 40 years and more, but equally this year in particular.
Sophie Petter is the Paris bureau chief for The Economist. Thanks, Sophie.
Thanks very much.
Later in the show, when does a dialect become a language? That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're tuned to The World. We've heard a lot in recent years about unaccompanied minors fleeing violence and poverty in Central America and coming to the U.S. But many more of these kids stop short of the border and end up staying in Mexico. And there, without any support, many of them get caught up in sex trafficking. Mexico has been stepping up its efforts to address the problem and help some of the victims. Reporter Amy Bracken caught up with one of them in the southern Mexican city of Frontera Comalapa.
I'll call her Mona. She asked that we not use her real name because she's not proud of her story. If I didn't know better, I'd think that Mona's 24 years on Earth had been good to her. She smiles easily and bounces around in bright white tennis shoes with pink laces. She was just 16 when she left her family home in San Pedro Sula, Honduras, out of what she calls youthful foolishness. She made her way through Guatemala to the mountain city of Frontera Comolapa, Mexico, where she quickly found a job waiting tables at a family restaurant. At least, that's how the gig was pitched to her. It was actually a bar, and she was hired to keep male customers company so they would buy more drinks and pay higher prices.
Era algo raro. O sea, feo, definitivamente.
It's weird. It's ugly, definitely. I can't imagine someone saying, oh, I like working in the bar. No.
Customers felt they could touch her as they pleased, she says. But as an undocumented minor, she saw no other options. And at least, unlike other employees, she never had sex with the customers. She was lucky, it seemed, because after she took up with the boss's son, he enabled her to leave the bar, letting her live with him and giving her money. And soon they had a baby. But there was no domestic bliss. What happened next was a grim, unintended consequence of well-meaning policy. In 2009, Mexico's first law criminalizing human trafficking went into effect. So police raided the bar Mona used to work at, arresting the owner, the mother of Mona's boyfriend, for exploiting minors. To get his mom out of jail, the boyfriend needed money. So he pushed Mona into prostitution. At first she refused, but ultimately she felt she had no choice.
Él me chantajeaba mucho con mi hija.
He was blackmailing me, and I was afraid he would take my daughter away.
He was Mexican, she was undocumented, and only his name was on the daughter's birth certificate. Mona was afraid if she went to the police, they'd have her deported. When the ex-boyfriend moved away with their daughter, Mona could only spend time with her by meeting her child and her ex-boyfriend in hotels, along with other men, Johns. With the help of her sister, Mona hired a lawyer, but it was fruitless.
We weren't making any progress, just going back and forth to the prosecutor's office in another city. I told him, I need to resolve this. What are we going to do? And months later, he said there's an attorney who helps immigrants. And that was the attorney, Elvira.
Elvira Gordillo Rivera is a native of Frontera Comolapa. I sit down with her and Mona in Rivera's downtown office. She's petite, with a short dress, very high heels, and a calm focus. Sometimes she wears an army vest with the logo of her employer, SMR, an international Catholic group that helps immigrants and refugees. When Mona met Elvira, everything changed.
Le digo, primero eres mujer y tienes dignidad.
I told her, first you are a woman and you have dignity. And I said, I promise to get your daughter back.
Within a month, Mona had her daughter back. The father was jailed for 2 years for extortion and human trafficking and is now barred from seeing their daughter. Rivera says it helped that she works with an international organization. She threatened the authorities, saying, if you deport Mona, this will be an international incident.
Estoy segura es una persona muy seria y...
She's a very serious person, and I explained to her my case, and from the first time...
Mona buries her face in her sleeve and cries, but soon she recovers.
O sea, me dio muchísimas esperanzas desde que le estaba contando. Me dijo, no te preocupes.
She gave me a lot of hope. She said, don't worry, you're in the right place. She had ways out I had never seen. She motivated me a lot. And thanks to God... Things went just as she said they would.
Not everyone is lucky enough to find someone like Rivera, but Rivera says it's also rare to get a client like Mona. She's tried to work with several victims of sex trafficking, and many services are now available to help them. But often they decline to press charges, and she says about 1 in 5 returns to sex work to support a drug habit. She says bar owners give employees cocaine so they can drink a lot with customers, and they get hooked. I ask Rivera if there's been a decrease in trafficking since it was criminalized and raids began.
No. La trata no baja porque...
No, the trafficking has not decreased because for men in this society, it is a necessary evil. Also, for organized crime, it's very lucrative.
She says that Frontera Comolapa is full of bars in which women are trafficked. Mona also doesn't see a cure, but she says talking about it helps. She agreed to our interview because she wanted to warn others. I asked her what she would say if she could speak to her 16-year-old self.
There are bad people who want to harm those who come from other countries and not give them opportunities, but there are also good people. So look for those people.
Mona says she's happy now, that being with her daughter is lo máximo, the greatest. But the journey's not over. She still needs to get Mexican residency, which will likely take months. And going back to Honduras is not an option, given the levels of violence there now. One reason so many young people like her continue to migrate to Mexico and the U.S. Once her papers are in order, she wants to go back to school and open a Honduran restaurant. She talks about her attorney, Rivera, with such admiration. I ask if maybe she wants to be a lawyer, too.
Más mi hija, creo que me gustaría que ella fuera abogada.
It's more my daughter who wants to be a lawyer, because she instilled in her the ethic of helping others, and also because she saw all this idiotic stuff I was doing. That's why she wants to do something good, help people.
Mona says she only spends time now with people she knows she can trust, her daughter, her best friend, and Rivera. But when her papers are in order, she plans to move to northern Mexico, where there is more opportunity to work and go back to school, and where there's a woman who will put her up. One of the good people she has found. For The World, Amy Bracken, Frontera Comalapa, Mexico.
Amy's reporting is part of our series on human trafficking. You can hear all the stories at pri.org/sold. Here's a preview of a story you'll hear Monday. It's about the president of the Philippines. He's a self-styled reformer, sometimes compared with Donald Trump. But you can see what makes President Rodrigo Duterte different from the U.S. president in his campaign to stop drug use in the Philippines. Our reporter asked a Duterte supporter about the president's use of lethal force against drug dealers and drug users.
In the West, we're reading about nearly 8,000 people killed in these operations, and that sounds like a massacre. What can you say to people who think that your president is a monster?
We have a 100 million population and 4 million drug addicts. 8,000 is, I think, very small.
How a strong man has won hearts and minds in the Philippines. We've got the story for you on Monday. I'm Carol Hills. Is it a dialect or a language? It's not as straightforward as you might think. Kind of like colors.
If you look at the color spectrum, red turns into orange by a series of very fine gradations. So at what point does red become orange?
It's all about history, politics, and power. From dialect to language, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's been a nerve-wracking 48 hours for Paul Gottinger and Mahsa Abbasi. They're engaged. Paul is American. Mahsa's Iranian. Mahsa's applied for a visa to come to the U.S. As of yesterday, though, she thought she wouldn't be able to. That's because of the Trump administration's reading of the Supreme Court's order this week on its travel ban. The administration said being engaged didn't count as a bona fide relationship. But then last night, they changed their mind. We reached Mahsa and Paul today in Istanbul.
So we went to bed thinking my fiancé is banned from the country, and I got up at 6 in the morning after kind of a restless night of sleep to find that that was no longer the case. I guess they had amended the rule and they're going to allow fiancés into the country because they consider them now close relatives.
So you must have been relieved but with that news.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing has been crazy. So it's obviously great news. We're both talking to our family and we're both super devastated by the ban. But we're back to where we were before, which is kind of just waiting. So we applied for the fiancé visa about a year ago. And they usually, my understanding is they take about 9 to 10 months. But because of the new administration, there's been additional vetting. And there's actually been a reduction of visas issued by the administration here to Muslim countries. So there seems to be some sort of delay. But we're back to just waiting, unfortunately.
Mahsa, tell me how you and Paul met.
Went online on Twitter. He was tweeting about something, I think, refugees crisis. And then I responded to him. And we started talking. I appreciated his work for refugees, for, you know, human rights, people of Middle East. And that's how we met. And soon after, we started developing some feelings and we wanted to meet. And that's what happened. We met in Istanbul for the first time. And then we fell in love. We decided to get married. And this is 150 days since we met.
Well, yeah, we have to kind of bounce back and forth between our two countries. Me as an American, it's difficult for me to go to Iran, and she obviously can't come to the U.S. So we're kind of trapped between our two countries. And we've been meeting in Istanbul and Armenia and trying to patch together some sort of normal relationship as best we can.
Paul, you applied for a K-1 visa, which is the fiancé visa. What's the process like?
People, I think they generally think that you can kind of just get the whirlwind wedding or get engaged and you can get on a plane and come to the U.S., and it's nothing like that, unfortunately. We have a huge packet. It's probably about as thick as what a Bible is, of all of our documentation, every flight we've taken to meet each other, every receipt, every hotel reservation, probably hundreds of pictures of us together. To document that our relationship is real, that this isn't some sort of scam or something. So there's that process. Then you have to actually go to, Matt's had to go and do an interview at the embassy in Armenia. There's no consulate or embassy in Iran. So she actually has to go abroad for that. And they put us into administrative processing, which is, my understanding, is an FBI check. And we've been there ever since. And if you ask the embassy what's going on, they just say, you know, it's out of our hands and there's nothing we can tell you right now.
Massa, what's the process been like for you?
Kind of frustrating, kind of hard. We didn't know what would happen to us. We didn't know when I would receive my visa, if I would be approved or not. And then all the bans and all the court rules kind of made it harder even for us. Every time that there's a ban, I feel like I'm having a heart attack because I don't know if I can start my life with the person that I love. We're just waiting and just waiting and waiting and waiting.
Massa, what does your family think? Are they all for this or are they a little nervous?
Oh, they are so nervous and they follow the news, actually, even kind of more than I do.
Paul, how about your family?
More or less the same. It's been a roller coaster ride. Massa family is much more connected to the news. I think it's like I'm telling my parents what's going on and they're kind of on the edge of my seat with me to update what's going on. My mom was under the impression that Massa would be coming with us on a family vacation when I get back to the U.S., I think, at the end of July. So she booked a place that would be big enough for us all, but unfortunately that's not going to happen now. We had a wedding venue actually booked for in June at a Japanese garden in Minnesota. That has come and gone as well. So we don't know. We're kind of stuck in this place, but trapped between two countries, and we can't really make plans. It was just like really difficult to know what's going to happen because we're trying to get a life started and we just feel like we can't get our wheels spinning.
Paul Gottinger and Massa Abbasi in Istanbul. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Back to North America now. We've been reporting this week on the possible closing of one of the biggest coal-fired power plants in the U.S. It's the Navajo Generating Station in northern Arizona. And it's not just the power plant that might close. The mine that supplies all of its coal could shut down along with it. That means a lot of lost jobs for Navajos and other local Native Americans. But for activists who've been protesting the mine for years, it's a win. Here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
Jessica Kitso introduces herself to me in Navajo before switching to English.
My name is Jessica Kitso. I'm a resident of the Black Mesa region. This place here, particularly my home, is called Tenid Ahotso.
Kitso's long dark hair nearly touches the ground as we sit on a little hill overlooking her family's land in northeastern Arizona.
So this land has been in our family for about 8 generations back. And we've grazed sheep and horses and cows on this land since we first came here.
There are also dogs.
Oh, no, no.
One runs up to try to lick us while we're talking.
Toodles, go away.
There are no neighbors for miles around. There's also no electricity or running water. So a couple times a week, Kitso or her dad spends a half a day in their truck hauling water in a huge tank over dusty roads.
Everything revolves around it. All of our jobs, all of our chores, it revolves around the water.
Inside the family's traditional 10-sided hogan, there are pitchers and buckets and basins.
And then we have, on the side of our tiny little house, 2 other 5-gallon buckets. And those are the drinking water and the cooking water. A lot of different places for water.
It's impossible to take water for granted out here. And that is the root of this family's concern about the Navajo Generating Station, the mammoth coal-fired power plant that's been part of the landscape here on the Navajo Nation for 40 years. Others criticize the plant as a major air polluter. But for this family, it's all about the water.
Peabody just has used a lot of our water.
Peabody Energy owns the nearby mine that supplies the plant's coal. They used to pump more than 3 million gallons of water a day from the same aquifer that lies under Kitso's home to process and transport coal. Now, Kitso's dad, Marshall Johnson, really started to worry about that after Jessica was born.
It made me realize that she had to have water. Her kids, her grandkids have to have water. If these operations continue, they will not have no water source.
Johnson started a nonprofit called Sacred Water Speaks. Kitso leads it now. She's helped organize rallies, speak at community meetings, and lobby the Navajo leadership to move to renewable energy.
You want to talk about this one?
It says power plant with a huge circle and a slash in it.
Kitso's little sister, Michaela Johnson, shows me one of the many protest signs stacked up by the fridge.
And then on the side, we have a happy sun, and then there's a little person there that's just smiling.
Peabody Energy has cut its water use by 70% over the last decade or so, but it still uses about 1 million gallons a day. The company says 50 years of studies show their water use hasn't damaged the aquifer, and federal scientists say their monitoring shows no impact to surface water either. But Kitso doesn't buy it.
The impacts that Peabody has had are visible.
She says springs have dried up, and that local elders have really seen the change. People like her grandmother.
Hello. Have a seat. There's a chair there. My name is Lena Hindley. I'm Jesse's grandmother. Right now, I'm 70. And when I was a little girl, we used to herd sheep.
Hindley remembers taking sheep out to desert washes.
Water was seeping out of the sand and the rocks. It was running like a river. It seems like we had a lot of water in those days.
Hindley still has sheep. She takes me out to their pen and points out where they drink now.
I have a water barrel back there.
She says there's not much coming up from the ground anymore.
When it rains or when it snows, we usually see water, but it's not coming out like the way it used to be.
But Hindley and her family are hoping that might change. The power plant may finally be closing. It's not because of the water issue. It's because the coal plant can't compete anymore with electricity from cheap natural gas. If the owners can't sell the plant in the next 2 years, it'll shut down. That means the mine would go too. For a lot of people in this isolated corner of the country, that's bad news. The closures will mean hundreds of high-paying jobs and millions in revenue will disappear.
We don't want any of those things.
Jessica Kitso has mixed feelings about the likely closing.
But from an environmental standpoint, we would like to keep living here. And in order to do that, our environment needs to be healthy. Water is everything in this region. If there's no water, we're not going to be able to survive.
For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Navajo Nation.
It's Friday, the start of what for many of us will be a very long 4th of July weekend this year. Millions of Americans are getting out of town today for our Independence Day holiday. Meanwhile, tomorrow, Canada celebrates its birthday. The country is turning 150 years old. But not everyone there is celebrating. A group of demonstrators have set up a teepee on Parliament Hill in Ottawa to protest Canada Day. They say Indigenous people have little reason to celebrate what they call their colonization. And Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has urged other Canadians to respect Indigenous groups' sentiment about the anniversary.
And I think it's important that even as Canada, as Canadians celebrate Canada 150, we reflect upon the experiences and the importance of folding in and hearing the stories and the experiences of Indigenous Canadians.
Tanya Talaga covers Indigenous issues for the Toronto Star. Tanya, what's your reaction to Prime Minister Trudeau's comments?
Well, Canada 150 is a hard thing for a lot of Indigenous people in this country because
for almost 13,000, 14,000 years Indigenous people have been here, and to celebrate a smaller block of time of 150, a time of which Indigenous people have gone through great hardship. It's really difficult for Indigenous people to celebrate Canada 150, and I think it's wise for the Prime Minister to say, you know what, we should all take a bit of a pause and respect the fact there are alternate views on the birthday.
What are some of the injustices Indigenous people in Canada are trying to call attention to?
Well, there's a number of them I could point to. I'll give you just a few of them. One in particular is the residential school crisis that happened in this country for quite a long time, from about 1860s to 1996. Actually, that was when the last residential school closed. Over 150,000 Indigenous kids were taken away from their families, from their culture, from their language, and they were put into schools that were funded by the government but run by the church. And for years, the kids were taken away from their families, and that did irreparable harm for generations. Another issue is murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls in this country. A couple of years ago, the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, put out a report that said that there were nearly 1,200 murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls in Canada from about 1980 to 2014. This is something that Indigenous people have known across the country for many, many years. A lot of the cases have been dismissed as accidental, and families have often said, we believe something else happened. They're still waiting for justice on what happened to their loved one.
I understand there's also been a lot of criticism about the amount of money being spent on this 150th anniversary.
It's been tens of millions of dollars. It's been quite a lot of money. And meanwhile, you have over 100 communities throughout Canada that do not have access to safe drinking water. These are First Nations communities, and they could have used that money to help bring clean water sanitation to the communities they live on. As well, the government of Canada has been taking Indigenous people to court over treaties and over the rights of Indigenous youth. There's so much waste of money, and a lot of Indigenous people look at how much money has been spent on the birthday party and wonder, why couldn't that have been given back to the people that actually need it?
Is there anything going on in the celebrations of Canada 150 that acknowledge the experience of Indigenous people?
I think there are. I mean, there are a lot of things happening on Parliament Hill. It seems as though organizers in various cities across Canada have also sort of bent over backwards to make sure they include the Indigenous viewpoint, Indigenous musical acts. And to be honest with you, it seems as if the Canada 150 has gone a little bit more subdued than it started at the beginning of the year when everyone was, you know, the flags were out, the government was just pumping messages all over the place. Things seem to have subdued quite a bit. And I think most Canadians realize that a lot's happened on this land for thousands of years before the settlers got here. And it's important to include everyone and think about what this country's history is really about.
That's Tanya Talaga, who covers Indigenous issues for the Toronto Star. Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills with
Nina Porzuki, and this is The World. I've always wanted to say that.
Nina's one half of the team behind our World in Words podcast. It's about language.
So, Carol, today I have a little quiz for you to start off our chat. I want you to tell me if the following varieties of speech are languages or dialects.
All right.
Okay.
Go for it.
So, the first one, Spanish.
Language.
Yes. Most people around the world would consider Spanish a language. It's a language. Okay. How about this one? Cantonese.
I'm going to say a language.
Here's where it gets a little bit tricky. So, if you were in China and you said Cantonese is a language, you know, the Chinese government would say, no, it's a dialect. But many people around the world would consider it a language because it is very, very different from Mandarin, which is the lingua franca of China. So okay. It depends on who you talk to there. And finally, for the last question on the quiz, I actually have a piece of tape.
Talking about like that, like if you had some wood out in the yard, instead of saying carry it in the house, she'd say tote it in the house. And like if you had something that you wanted to put in a paper bag, you'd put in a paper poke, you know, instead of a paper bag. Well, the way people talk around here, I guess it'd be what more like you call hillbilly style or something, I guess. I don't know, just mountain talk.
I'm going, you know, it's obviously a variant of English, and I'm going to call it a dialect.
Yeah, so this is a dialect spoken in southern Appalachia, and the excerpt actually that we heard is from a film called Mountain Talk. about the dialect. Notice that it's not just an accent. So there are words that are unique to this variety of speech. Like you said, you know, poke for a paper bag. You could kind of hear that. So it's not just an accent. It is actually a dialect. And this week on The World in Words, we're looking at some of the complications that come with defining language and dialect. And I played the last example because one way in which dialects are defined traditionally is they are mutually intelligible.
So that means that a dialect, it's part of some other language. So I speak English, Mountain Talk is in English. It sounds quite a bit different, may have some words of its own, but I can still understand it.
Yes, mutual intelligibility. However, this idea of mutual intelligibility, this definition for what is a dialect, it breaks down in so many ways. This week on the podcast, we look at two places that defy definitions, and one of those places is Scandinavia.
Okay, let's listen to a bit.
Do you know the it's sort of like a crime series called The Bridge?
Charlotta Guskins is a linguist at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, though she's originally from Denmark. Danish is her mother tongue. She's a big fan of the Danish-Swedish TV series The Bridge. Now, you might have caught the U.S. adaptation of the show. It took place between the U.S. and Mexico. But she's talking about this Danish-Swedish original series.
A bridge between two worlds.
You know there's a bridge between Copenhagen and Sweden, so you can drive across the water from Denmark to Sweden.
A bridge between good and evil. And between two cops of two nations.
And in the middle of this bridge, there's this body found. And because it's precisely on the border of Sweden and Denmark.
What looks like a single crime.
The police from Denmark and from Sweden are involved in finding the murderer.
Turns into high-tech serial killings, threatening all of Scandinavia.
So they speak Danish and Swedish during the whole series to each other.
And this delights Charlotta because this is exactly what she studies. No, not murder, but mutual intelligibility.
You must have been excited speaking mutual intelligibility.
Yeah. Yeah, I use it a lot as an example to show that it how it works.
So that's kind of interesting. Danes and Swedes can talk with one another in their own languages, yet they understand each other.
Yes, and that is the key linchpin that you said there was language. So Danish, Swedish, and actually Norwegian, they are all mutually intelligible languages, not dialects.
So does that mean that to us, Norwegian, Sweden, and Danish are languages, but among Danes, Swedes, and Norwegians, they consider each other's languages dialects?
No, they consider them languages. That's where this whole breakdown of language versus dialect and the definition gets really murky. So I spoke with one language expert. His name is Lane Green, and he writes a language column for The Economist. And what he calls them is neighbor languages.
They are neighbors. They're close to each other. They have an entwined political history. They were all part of a single union once upon a time. Then they split up, and for most of that time, Norway was part of Denmark, and the language of Norway was essentially Danish spoken in a different way. Sweden went its own way. And then for 100 years, I think, or so, Norway became part of Sweden and then became independent.
This term neighbor languages makes it all sound so very cozy. But it wasn't always so cordial and cozy. As Lane Green pointed out, Denmark and Norway was a political union from the 14th until the 19th century. And the written language of Norway during that time was actually Danish. So then in 1814, we're getting into a little bit of history here, Norway was more or less handed over to the Swedes. And this second union lasted for almost another 100 years until Norway gained independence in 1905. And during that near century of rule under the Swedes, the Norwegians debated how to distinguish their written form from Danish. So there were two camps. Should they go back to written Norwegian, the Old Norse of the 14th century before Danish rule, like so way going way back, or should they just Norwegianize what already existed? And that schism still is playing out in Norway today.
So they have this complicated political situation, but now they're very friendly. And there's lots of travel, lots of people who live in different countries, marry across the lines and so forth. And there's this concept of neighbor languages because it would be odd to call them foreign languages. Written Danish and written Norwegian are so close that it's just like one slightly spelled differently. Swedish is more different still. the Swedish speech sounds a lot more like Norwegian speech. So sometimes there's a joke that Norwegian is Danish spoken with a Swedish sound system or Swedish accent. So that's how close they all are.
Wow, I'm exhausted.
Yeah, I know, it's complicated.
You know, because I always hear you guys, you and Patrick Cox, you two do the World in Words podcast, and I always heard you guys quip, a language is a dialect with an army. So I guess it's a lot more complicated than that.
Well, I mean, that's the whole saying, the cliched saying, a language is a dialect with an army and navy. But it is rather complicated. This week on the podcast, we wade into this sort of complication, and we kind of drill down and try and find some kind of meaning in all of this muck.
I look forward to the muck. You can find The World in Words on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Nina Porzucki from our language desk. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Carol.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.